Hello and welcome to the latest episode of the Testing Peers. Tonight we're going to be talking about linguistic gatekeeping. That's easy for me to say. We'll explain exactly what we mean by that a bit later on when we get into our actual topic. But tonight we have two of the regular co-hosts. So we have Chris.
Hello.
And Simon.
I guess I'm semi-regular now, but hello.
True. And then we have Sam.
Hi everyone, nice to be here again.
And I'm David. We'd like to thank our sponsors, as always. Saffron QA continue to sponsor our podcast, and they are also here to support the testing community. Therefore, should any of our listeners be in the market for a new job in testing or hiring new talent for your team, please reach out to Ben. He can be contacted via email at ben@saffronqa.co.uk. As is normal, we have banter, and as is semi-normal, we go to Chris.
There's very little that's normal. We'll call it just sort of expected, almost disappointing like you do. Okay. I was talking with my eldest this week about I told you so. He did something, didn't he? He got in trouble. And of course, mum and dad had already told him so, but he had to learn that lesson because he had to go and try that thing all for himself in order to find out. Because we all think we're smarter than our parents when they tell us that we can't and we shouldn't do those sorts of things. I was wondering if you've ever had an I told you so moment, either with a child or maybe you when you were a child, or maybe even a grown up looking at you, Simon. Is there anything you can think of as like you were warned against doing it, but you did it anyway, and there was a bit of an I told you so moment?
Every single day.
It didn't happen to me, but it happened to my sister. We went to my grandparents and they had an oil burner in the bathroom which was leaking hot oil, and she was told not to touch it, and she did touch it and got oil down her forearm and it burnt her really badly. But yeah, she learned not to touch hot things again. I can't think of anything that's happened to me, but I might come back with that.
I can think of a few. I mean I think my wife must say that to me every day when she says you shouldn't have done that, I told you so. But the example that sticks in my mind was from when I was about 6 or 7. And I was at Clacton Beach in the UK, and my grandparents were with me, and I was bouncing a plastic ball on the sort of promenade along the front, big drop onto the beach. And I was bouncing it, and they're going, don't keep bouncing it. The wind's going to take it. It's going to go into the sea. And I was like, it's fine. It's fine. Just kept bouncing it. And obviously the wind took it. And it took it at a point where we were midway between both sets of steps at either end of the promenade. So I was like, where do I run to? So I spent 5 minutes panicking about whether I'm going to shuttle left or shuttle right to go and get it. By the time I got it, it was in the sea. I had to run into the sea, you know, take my trousers off to run in or whatever I did at the time to get into the sea. And I was a complete sopping mess by the time I got the ball back. It wasn't worth it keeping it. It was a cheapy plastic ball, but you know, like when you're 6 or 7, it was meant the world to me at that point. So yeah, my grandparents told me so.
I guess I had this situation a lot because boundaries for me were often an introduction to or an invitation to test them out. To be honest, find I told you so may be the most unhelpful thing anyone can say to someone. And that doesn't mean that I don't say to my kids, but I try not to either. I can't think of a single situation where I told you so brought any value to any situation.
There's a lot of exasperation as a parent when those things happen. The example I have is one where I had been told repeatedly not to walk along a wobbly wall in our garden, but we always used to do that to get to the garden because the garden was like down a hill. And so you'd go on the wall and then jump onto the grass at the bottom. And we were always told, don't do on that, it's not safe. And I managed to prove my parents correct with their assertion as the wall fell with me down onto the ground, shattered, bit of brick, maybe about an inch, went into my leg, broke both the bones, severed the artery and a vein. And 5-year-old Chris had a lot of blood coming out of him all of a sudden. My parents eventually did say, we told you so. Not at that moment. There was a bit more of an urgent need to address the whole blood and broken stuff situation. It got resolved and I can still walk and do all those good things. But sometimes we should probably learn to listen to advice, but it can be quite frustrating, right? Like we're told things and we still don't follow advice and blah, blah, blah. But Yeah, it was less lighthearted and more
Well,
bad.
My kids are going into the age where telling them to not do something is, again, like, you better not tell them, because the chances they try it anyway is higher. That's actually a good thing. That's at least what I try to remind myself as a parent, that this is how it needs to go, how nature needs to go.
There's an element of that boy who cries wolf thing as well, right? If you everything you tell them they can't do all the time, you're almost encouraging those things. You almost need to find a balance so they know that this one thing is definitely no. These things you shouldn't do it, but if you find out, I'll just be a bit upset.
Yes, pick your fights, especially with teenage children.
You've said the perfect line to lead us into the next piece, Sam, because picking your fights. Oh my gosh, linguistic gatekeeping. What do we mean? I came up with the topic, so I'll tell you the pitch and then we'll dive in. But language is power. The way we use it, the way we own it, the way we keep it to ourselves or amongst other certain areas of work, or almost to demean or to show power over other people. I have observed a reasonable amount of this that goes on in our software development lives. I think there are sometimes reasons for this that are positive. I think there are reasons for this that are negative. I think it's a worthy conversation to have, because I do think just complaining about it probably won't help us get anywhere. But if we discuss about it, maybe we'll have some tips and tricks, some lessons learned, some good things, and maybe we can call out some things that we don't think are particularly helpful.
I think it sounds like a plan. I mean, I think without going into specific examples straight away, I think one of the things I've certainly experienced recently is where people get hung up on, they don't want to move on from a discussion until they've finalized exactly what the terminology is that's going to be used. And actually what happens is there's people like myself, like semantics, doesn't matter, let's just get on with the work. But some people feel they have to stop and define every intricate thing and what that's going to be called and what that's going to be called before we move forward. And I think it's just understanding where there's a place for that and where there isn't, and looking at the bigger picture.
I wonder what the reason is, because I can think of several different reasons. So I can imagine some people need clarification on semantics because it gives them security. But in other situations, people might want to be very clear and very specific on terms to raise their power and to control other people. And these are two very different things. And
yeah, motivations, I think, yeah, ultimately are what makes either the pursuit of definition and the sort of the gatekeeping of language either a positive or a negative thing. But clarification and being on the same page, I think we would all agree, is very, very important. Where David and I used to work, there was a handshake that needed to take place between different networks in order to agree. And so they would start at a very slow baud rate. I think it was maybe like 300, just to initiate a conversation, say, hello, I am this thing. How fast can you speak? And then we go, oh, I can speak 19,200. And they go, oh, great, we'll converse at this level. And it was starting at that lowest common denominator. And then you work your way out to find yourself on the same page. And very often, I think the trap that I have seen is where either someone's not read the room right, and either they've pitched it too low in terms of speed, and they've said they've sort of treated the room as not very clever, and then people have obviously then made assumptions. Assumptions are not great in our lives. Or they've gone so high that other folks are missing, and that's that sort of more gatekeeping-y area. And I think that's a skill in and of itself, is reading the room, the audience, and understanding the context. I had to get context in.
Yeah, I was going to say the context. I think also sometimes I think that there can be sometimes politics involved. You know, people going back to the banter of people proving themselves right. Oh, I was right in that respect. You know, what I said was right. My understanding was correct. And going around that loop many times to try and reinforce that particular understanding. But I completely agree. It depends on the context, And people who are always like that are quite sort of destructive in productivity, I would say, because there's constantly that barrier of we have to cross. And I have been in times when I dread people being in the meeting because exactly like Simon says, you want to get things done, you want to get things moving. But if you've got that person in the room, your heart can sink and think, oh my gosh, I hope I haven't got another meeting after this. It's going to drag on until they till they get their way. So either I argue my point or I agree with them to just get the work done.
Yeah, and I think the first example that comes to my mind of this that historically I've had to deal with, and I used to dread this discussion, was the whole test plan versus test strategy discussion for projects. Because there'd always be people in the room like, that's not a strategy, that's a plan. Does it matter what it's called? Can we just do it? And it would just cause a 10-minute dispute. Well, no, this can't be a strategy. You're not talking about the risks. You're not talking about this. Well, okay, doesn't matter what it's called. Let's just create an approach or whatever we want to call it. It's always a challenge. But it's like you say, David, it's about working out how best to deal with it.
I think the names of documentation is a complete minefield for exactly that. But we've got processes as part of our documentation. And as we say, you know, it depends on the size of the project that we do as to whether you have a separate plan to a strategy. You know, they can be combined into one. If needs must, then make it small. You don't have to cross all the T's and dot all the I's just because the process says so. You need to have it in terms of, you need to justify actually why you might be combining them, but actually that's fine in certain situations. You don't have to just produce a document just because the process says so.
Yeah, I'd be very curious why the people in this certain situation, why they feel the need to differentiate between a test strategy and a test plan. Because there are different possible reasons. Maybe they fear they will miss something if they don't look at the right angle. And maybe they are just pissed and want to derail the discussion to very different situations.
Motivations again, yeah. Like sometimes it is people who just think that's the way you have to do it. Those are the rules. That's the way that it was defined by AN other standards.
I was going to mention the standard, but yeah, it was usually they would waive that standard. Oh, look, the definition says it's this. Mm. Great, okay, but is that going to help us?
That, and that can happen, and also we can be anchored by experience or by what someone that we've maybe revered as an expert has told us. All of these things, you know, they're prevalent, and in an industry like ours where there are more standards than there are, you know, a standard way of approaching things, it can be quite tricky because the context is different everywhere. The team composition, the skill composition, the target market that we're working on, it's going to be different. And we can't just apply a blanket standard across all of those ways. We can certainly use heuristics and models to drive us. But then there's the whole stuff about job titles and roles and responsibilities and all those things. You could have two people who have the exact same job title who do a completely different job in two different organizations. You can have people who are mortally offended by the words that are in your job title, even if the role that you serve is, you know, very valuable. Our good friend Patrick Prill was once a quality owner in a job role. I think we sort of joke that probably not very helpful. Paddy certainly has done so himself, you know, and people say, I can't assure quality, so why would I be in quality assurance and blah, blah, blah. But there's normally a reason, normally.
Yeah, I find it interesting, your example. I can't assure quality, so I can't be quality assurance. For me, that communicates a need or a goal of the person who complains, which is, I don't want to be responsible alone for the whole process. And that's a valid goal. And I would, so if we come to semantics and to like linguistic gatekeeping, my first thing would always be trying to find out the goal that person has with their approach, because usually we have goals. And maybe it's just, I don't want to be responsible, or I want to stick to standards because they give me some confidence. And bad things happened last time I didn't follow the process. And
It's very, very true. It's again, it's all of that cognitive biases and anchoring. There is always a reason for something, even if that reason was, I read it somewhere that's how we're supposed to do it.
It might be a case of it's the way that that person in particular has always done it. And actually, they just can't get past that someone would do it differently.
And there's fear, isn't there, sometimes to change things. There's rigidity, there's politics, as you've mentioned already. There's a lot that goes into these things.
And even, let's not forget, and even, I don't like you, I want you out of this room, and therefore...
Yeah. Oh, using things to cut people out, my friend. It's, you know, I think we've used examples of going, oh, this is probably going to get a bit technical now, so you might not want to.
Yeah, that was it. Yeah, any technical discussion, testers don't need to be in the room. Sorry, we're going to talk technical. Right, okay.
We've given a few fleeting examples of where we've seen sort of some problems areas. We've sort of given some fluffy explanations as to where maybe why they are these situations. But do we have any sort of examples or stories of things where maybe we've come across these things and how we've tackled them either successfully or unsuccessfully? Have we got anything, pearls of wisdom, some lessons learned, some war wounds that have come off the back of any of these things that maybe can actually help our listeners, and we'll have a bit of a practical application that we can maybe suggest a heuristic in terms of tackling linguistic gatekeeping?
I'm in the situation that I am very experienced in some topics and very, very novice in other topics. For example, testing and all your test strategy and test plans. That's something I know so little about, to be honest, that I can't have a useful conversation about it. So there might be situations where I just can't follow. And if we're not in a hostile environment, my strategy is, if I'm not clear, then I ask specifically, because I'm talking to experts, and experts usually forget that the things they are building upon took them 20 years of experience to be easy. So they are not even aware. They use words, they use contexts that other people who don't have the same experience level don't understand. So I try to ask and make it easy for the other people to see, Sam is not very experienced in that area, in a non-hostile environment. In a hostile environment, I will absolutely not do this because it makes me vulnerable.
It's certainly also a good, I would suggest, modeling of humility. And sometimes we're asking those questions for the benefit of other people as well. But I think clarification, I mean, we're taught to ask questions, why, and to funnel and to dig a bit deeper. I don't think there's any harm in getting clarification on those things. You're right, Sam, that there are hostile environments where that won't be well received, but that's a whole different level of sort of toxic culture that we probably don't need to deal with right now. But yeah, asking questions, clarifying these things, it's super important. I would, if I had the opportunity to find out why they're using language along those lines today versus other things. I get asked often in consulting, what's the industry standard with certain language and references? And it's difficult because it is different depending on what you've decided the standard you want to do. The term best practice can be quite a dangerous bit of language to use, and people will have different alternatives that they will use, because best practice can be inferred as that's what I have to do in order to do the job correctly or the best. And that often isn't context specific, is it? Uncovering context is quite tricky, especially when it comes to decisions, possibly legacy decisions that folks that you're working with now don't even know why it is. Yeah, it's tough, David.
I was going to say that you've reminded me about working for a consultancy and having clients, is that often the terminology can be different between ourselves and the client. And so therefore making sure that the understanding of what they're going to get delivered is what we are actually going to deliver them, because otherwise that can cause all sorts of problems. I'd also like to go back to Sam's point in that as I've become more experienced, is asking questions is so important to confirm understanding. And I do completely agree about the sort of hostility and knowing when to keep quiet, but also knowing when to go, I don't understand that. Because we are all learning, you know, even if you're more experienced, there will be times when you haven't got the foggiest what's going on. But experience gives me the confidence of going, I don't understand that. Can you explain that a bit further? What's that acronym? I've come from a different place. I understand it as this. What do you mean by that? And that is so important because, again, as Sam said, I'm asking the questions that lots of other people may well be asking silently in their own head and not have the confidence in order to actually ask.
Yeah, you're definitely right. It has to be about challenging the gatekeeping from that perspective and looking at why they're using that term or why they're making half the room feel uncomfortable because they're standing against what they're trying to do. And I've certainly been in situations where you mentioned acronyms, where someone will deliberately speak in acronyms from the context that they're in because they know it's going to confuse people because they want to look as if they're the big I am that has all the knowledge. And you are effectively gatekeeping that audience from being part of that conversation. So then you step in as the one that's not afraid to ask the question and go, what does that mean? What does that mean? Can you explain what these acronyms are? And then it's that whole, oh, sorry, I didn't realize you didn't know the acronyms. Well, no, I don't. I'm new. Can you please share? And just be the difficult person, as uncomfortable as that could be sometimes, to try and bring the room round. And then afterwards in that situation, I got the three or four people from the room going, thanks for asking the question. I was sitting there wondering what the hell he was talking about. And it's just, you realize that everyone else in the room is feeling the same thing, but sometimes you have to be the one that will step up and ask the why and ask the questions. And it has to be the first step, is to challenge it, to ask the question.
Do you know, there's also sometimes language that we've used for a long time and haven't seen the context of how that language itself can be dangerous or harmful or not inclusive as well. You know, we've seen conversations in the not too distant future where people are saying, don't say hey guys to a room because we're not speaking to just guys, because that would be seen as mostly a male sort of dominant room. There's stuff about grooming, which is where my Freudian slip just fell there. We changed to refinement. There's reasons where words can actually have negative connotations for folks before you even start diving into it. And I don't know if you, it's true also, like maybe if people with very strong language can sometimes put folks off to the point where they don't want to listen to the message or the conversation, that you lose respect for people because of the way they may be not respectful in the way that they're approaching their language, the use of language with those things. I wholeheartedly apologize to folks like Sam who've got names that I would find naturally difficult to pronounce, like their last name. Is it Nietzsche?
Yes, it's
Nietzsche. But do you know, it can be quite hard to do something that we don't understand. And again, humility is to come in and say, you know, well, how would I say that name? What do you call these sorts of things? I noticed you grimace when I refer to something. Is there something wrong? Was there another way that you would refer to those things? If we're going to try and model a more inclusive way of doing things, we've got to accept that we're probably not going to get things right first time very often. No matter how hard we try, there will be things that we say, things that we do. And it's being open and inviting to feedback that can quite often be quite a powerful goal that we can use. You know, I worked, you know, in electronics, there was a master and a slave. Well, obviously that's got some negative connotations that we don't really want to be using going forward. And you can sort of see these things, the same with branching strategies and naming of things. It is interesting. And I guess sort of being empathetic, being aware of your surroundings is something, maybe a superpower that we can have or learn or be more aware of. But I don't think being respectful is a superpower. I think that's a basic human thing that we should do.
No, but it comes down to that self-awareness thing, doesn't it? And being aware of your room, as you mentioned earlier. You actually remind me of the master and slave conversation. I remember one of my first experiences with real hostility towards documentation was we were talking about some networking feature or something, and the documentation clearly in our wiki page talked about the master and the slave and how it connected and communicated to each other and whatever else. And some new people came into it and they just absolutely ripped it to shreds, saying, "This is not okay. This is not okay. This is upsetting. How can you use those terms?" And we were just like, "But this is the standard documentation. We've not changed any of it. It's all as it's communicated online." And it was that whole realization, well, maybe we need to think about how we make that more accommodating for the people that are offended by it. And it was a real eye-opener that, you know, we thought we were doing the right thing, but actually, you need to be more aware of that situation. If someone's raising a concern, then there's a reason for it and you deal with it. And the same goes for if you're using language in a meeting or in discussions that's discriminatory or negative or it gives the wrong impression, is be open to the idea that it's not going to sit well with everybody and therefore work with them to find an alternative that does.
The moment in my life where I feel that a lot of things got easier was when I realized that there are hardly any absolutes and there are hardly any things that are always like this. And that made taking feedback and critique a lot easier, because suddenly it was, yeah, okay, I just don't know of all the different things and contexts. On the other hand, it also led to a lot of confusion, because if there are so many possibilities, which is the right thing to do? And I was just thinking about that with what Simon said, that uncertainty you get once you realize, oh, there are no absolutes, because absolutes are great because they give you so much confidence. Like the, yeah, I will say it, like the clean coat sealots, it's all so easy. It's all so specific and clear. Absolutes, great thing for confidence. So, and when you don't have the confidence, you need a strategy to deal with that uncertainty. And I know for me, it was very important to develop such a kind of strategy, which was, if there are different contexts to interpret something or to judge is something harmful for someone, always look for who is the most vulnerable, because they are most affected and they should have the say. And that's a very powerful strategy that I learned from Kim Creighton. And I'm glad for both that I learned, okay, I don't need the certainty, but also learned to have a strategy to deal with the answer.
It's advocacy, isn't it? Yeah, and we can joke about QA stands for quality advocate, but I think advocacy is certainly there, and maybe as we get more experienced or more confident, or maybe we're in a privileged position of being a bit more leaders, we have more of a responsibility to advocate, whether that's for clients or for the vulnerable or for those that don't have that platform or don't feel ready to model those things, to challenge things, to hold our hands up when we're challenged, invite those sorts of things as well. Because, man, like, you're right, Sam. It when you think everything is, if I do this, it's right. If I do this, it's wrong. It's quite simple. It's a life of two choices. And obviously, I think I'm a good person, so I'm going to pick good. But it is infinite multiverse of options and choices. And it gets very convoluted very quickly if you concern yourselves always with just two choices. Next move on, two choices. Next move on, two choices. It's having the sort of ability to be aware, to ask questions, to have tools and heuristics to sort of lean on to tackle and challenge those things, not just when it comes to testing, because of course we don't always know what's going to happen when we do the thing, or for whom that's going to be beneficial, but also in our workplaces, in our documentation, in our language, our meetings, it's very different, and it's a challenge. It's a creative challenge, I would argue. I think a lot of our industry is creative. We have to think on our toes very often and bend and brace, flex to some of those bits. I think it's interesting, and I don't think it ever will come to an absolute, like you say.
I think it's also important as leaders and testers is to know when to pull back, when to actually not be constantly confrontational, you know, when to compromise. And compromise is a major thing in all of this, is to understand, okay, I'm not going to win this battle. I'm using battle as talking about language. You know, sometimes there is conflict. Sometimes there is people, or there are people who are more assertive than others, and actually just let them get on with their discussion, and we can just then pull off and pull back. And as Simon says, get on with the job in hand.
What hill are you willing to die on? That's what they ask, isn't it?
Well, and I think if you always want to have an area to go and test these boundaries out, I mean, LinkedIn's full of people that have differing views on semantics. So you can get involved in discussions there, and that may help you to challenge the workplace. I think, you know, we can always get hung up on, as we mentioned earlier, job titles, what the team's called. You know, someone goes into a new context and the team's called quality engineering rather than QA. Suddenly that gets them confused, or people start going, it's not QA around here, it's QE. I've heard that a few times in different places where and it all comes back to having the empathy, having self-awareness, and being prepared to ask the questions. And if you can do those three things, you can try and settle down the conflict in some form when it comes to language.
And if you want to protect yourself, and I recommend everyone who engages publicly on the internet to protect themselves, learn to differentiate between people who discuss to learn and people who discuss just to run over you again and again.
Because later,
just don't discuss with them. There is no point.
And I think on that's probably a really good point to stop. So thank you all for the discussion. Thank you again to Saffron QA for continuing to sponsor us. Thank you everyone for listening. You can find us at contactus@testingpeers.com or on most of the socials, most likely to get a response from us on LinkedIn. So search for Testing Peers. And if you've not seen or heard the news, we have just announced recently that PeersCon 25 will be happening. Check out testingpeerscon.com for all information about tickets and when we will announce the call for collaboration, but it will be at the same venue in Nottingham next year on the 13th of March. So we look forward to seeing you then.
Thank you very much for having me, and hope to see you again.
For now, it's goodbye from the Testing Peers.
Goodbye.